Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
Howdy. I am Lieutenant Colonel Retired Alan West, President and CEO of the National Center for Policy Analysis and former member of the United States Congress. And you are listening to Audrey Russo, my dear friend, on Real Talk Radio. Listen up, or else I'll drop you for push-ups. Thank you.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. And that bumper was Crossfire by Stevie Ray Vaughan. To listen to Western leaders today concerning the slaughter of Christians in the Middle East and Africa by followers of Muhammad, you'd believe these victims were merely caught in the crossfire. Well, my next guest begs to differ, and I agree. For my new listeners, Raymond Ibrahim is, among other distinguished positions, a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center and a CBN News contributor. He's a guest lecturer at universities and governmental agencies, and he's testified before Congress regarding the abstract failures that direct American dialogue concerning Islam. He's also the author of several books, including The Al-Qaeda Reader, and his latest release, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Raymond Ibrahim. Welcome back, Raymond.
Hi, Audrey. I'll say it again. I always get the best reception from your show. The applause and all.
I'm glad. And it's well-deserved, so at least you'll get
Thank
it
you.
Here, okay? So, well, it's always great to have you with us. We're looking forward to your assessments on this stuff. Raymond, we've been aware that the situation for Coptic Christians has never been good since Egypt has been a majority Muslim country. An example of this, even under a more secular President Sisi, was seen recently when cops were arrested for mocking, of all things, ISIS. Can you expound on that for us?
Sure. Well, the backdrop to, you know, for context is CC appears to be a reformer, and, you know, I believe he's sincere, especially based on some remarks he made in front of fellow Muslims, where he basically said, we as the Islamic world can't continue being a source of misery and terror to the rest of the world. We as in Muslims have to look at our texts that basically incite this sort of behavior against the so-called infidel. We have to reform, etc. So that's Sisi, and that is some other Muslims around the world. Then there's the reality, which is, you know, a leader can only do so much, because the country is still an Islamic country. The culture is still there. The mosques are still there, inciting people. The texts are still there, and so forth. And so that's the backdrop. And then in the context of the cops, most recently what happened, and this is just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, in Egypt they have what's called it's sort of like a blasphemy law, and it's called defamation of religions, but it's worded in a way that implies anyone who mocks any religion, theoretically, if a Muslim mocks a Christianity, for example, or Judaism, so forth, they too could be convicted. But it's almost, as in Pakistan and in other Islamic nations, it's almost exclusively used to target Christian minorities. And so the most recent victims of this are a Coptic Christian teacher and his students. And their great crime is that on his iPhone, he videotaped, I think, some of his students mocking ISIS, the Islamic State. So what they were doing is they were pretending that they're praying like ISIS, because ISIS is pious and religious Muslims, and then they go and pretend they're decapitating each other, and they're just making fun of it. So somehow his iPhone fell into the wrong hands, and some Muslims saw it, reported it, and so forth. Long story short, he and the students that they could gather were arrested. Muslims rose up in riots, attacked the village. It's called Al-Nasriya in Upper Egypt that he is from, this teacher. And they threw stones and rocks at Coptic homes. They said, we, Islam, with our life, we will die for you. And, you know, churches were attacked, and the usual, basically. And the Christians of that village had to actually renounce or denounce that Coptic teacher, and now he's banished from the village, even if he gets out of jail, and he could face up to 7 years just because of that. And what I think is ironic is, keep in mind that Muslims are habitually telling us that the Islamic State is not Islamic and that it doesn't represent Islam. And yet here you have everyday Muslims up in arms because this Coptic teacher made fun of not Islam per se, but of the Islamic State. And so that gives you an idea of how much Muslims do believe that the Islamic State is representative of Islam and does stand for Islam and so forth. So that's just one of the many examples right now in Egypt.
Wow. You know, I'm just curious, after President Sisi made those comments about the need for reform in Islam, was there a backlash from the... Yeah, was there?
Sure, oh yeah. Well, I mean, amongst the hardcore types who have already hated him because, of course, he ousted the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the granddaddy of all the jihadi organizations. So he's already been hated, but now he's basically, he's an apostate, of course, because he dares. He himself can be seen, according to a lot of these people and organizations, as blaspheming against Islam because he dared to state the obvious and the truth, which is that Islam is a source of terror against the entire world. So definitely he's hated for that. And like I said, you know, he's in a very tough position because it's just, you know, it's human nature to look at a leader and think, you know, this leader can change everything top down. But you can't, because he's just one temporal finite man, whereas what we're talking about is 1,400 years worth of teachings and culture embedded in the fabric of Egyptian society and also all the Arab countries. So, you know, how much can he really do and change, even if he wants to very sincerely? Because every step forward, you know, then he's accused. For example, I understand he's trying to clean out some of the texts. We have found out, for example, that Al-Azhar, one of the most prestigious universities, certainly in Egypt, Islamic institution, university, the books that they use has and teaches all the things that ISIS is doing, burning people alive, decapitating them, even eating infidels if you need to. So you can see the problem, you know, it's not, everyone likes to say it's there, it's localized, it's ISIS. It's not. ISIS is a manifestation of a much deeper problem in Islam itself. And there's some who want to admit it, some who don't, but, you know, there it is.
Sure, yeah. You know, I understand we now have Christians as prisoners of conscience in Uzbekistan. Now, Raymond, can you give a little background on Uzbekistan? And can you tell us, has it always been a majority Muslim country?
Well, you know, regarding the latter question, you know, all the majority Muslim countries today were never majority Muslim countries at a certain point in their history. They became majority Muslim countries after the jihad entered them historically from hundreds of years ago. And the people, you know, they embraced that either you convert or you live as a third-class citizen. And most people eventually convert because they don't want to live as third-class citizens, paying extra money and extortion, living in fear. So the story of Uzbekistan is very similar to the story of many other Islamic countries, Egypt, Algeria, and so forth. But Uzbekistan went through a certain history under the USSR. It was part of the Soviet Republic, and so they had communism and atheism also came in. So right now, a couple decades ago, Uzbekistan would still be Muslim majority, but it was very much secularized because of its experiences. But now, once again, we're seeing a turn, you know, this sort of, as they like to call it, a return to a conservative Islam, just like we're seeing in Turkey and these other countries. And there's definitely, the government itself is very strong against any kind of proselytizing Christianity or preaching or even churches. There's a lot of strong regulations and laws insofar as, you know, where a church can be built. And again, this is all very similar to other Islamic countries. So you're seeing a country you wouldn't think of, like Uzbekistan, and you don't think of it as Islamic jihadi stuff, but it's coming back there as well. A neighboring country, Tajikistan, I recall, for example, of all places, I think it was two Christmases ago, a man was dressed as Santa Claus, and he was attacked and killed as the Muslims there were screaming infidel, and he was killed in the street, yeah, because he was, I think, giving gifts to people. And that was enough. And this is Tajikistan, neighboring Uzbekistan. So if those countries that you never really associate with this sort of Islamic radicalism are doing that, you can just imagine in the heart of it how it's like.
Wow. Incredible. You know, there's an Islamic jihad, of course, we know, on Christians taking place in the Middle East. The leftist media ignores this reality, but it is a reality, isn't it, Raymond?
Well, it's an absolute reality. You know, last Friday, for example, was the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of, the Armenian Genocide.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think most people by now are familiar with that term, the Armenian Genocide. They don't really know the mechanics behind it and what's behind it. But the more you delve into it, the more you realize it's just another chapter of the things that we're talking about and the things that we're seeing right now. So, for example, it wasn't an Armenian genocide. It was actually a genocide of Christians under the Ottoman Caliphate, and this is the last caliphate. And the reason I say that is because while the Armenians were the most who were attacked and targeted because they were the largest Christian minority, all the Christian minorities under the Ottoman Empire were slaughtered and crucified and killed, including Greeks and Assyrians. The Assyrians continue to be killed right now, still, by ISIS. So, and if you look at the text, and again, the backdrop, you're going to find there's fatwas by the Ottoman Empire saying, kill the Christians, kill the infidel. And if you do, you as a Muslim are going to get the greatest rewards, if not here, via plunder and slaves and so forth. And in the afterlife, Allah will grant you double the reward and so forth. So it was all the same rhetoric, same motivation, same fatwas that we're seeing right now with the Islamic State, who is the newest caliphate. The Ottoman Caliphate, of course, was dissolved around 1924, and that was the final caliphate of the Islamic world up until now, where we have the Islamic State, which calls itself the new caliphate, and it's behaving just like the old caliphate and all the older caliphates before it by basically cleansing the regions of infidels, non-Muslims, Christians, Yazidis, so forth, enslaving them, killing them, burning them alive, and so forth. So to me, it's just amazing because, you know, ISIS is just another chapter in a long, long, long history of identical patterns. And yet, you know, here in the West, we don't, of course, see that. We don't make the connection. When you talk about the Armenian Genocide, religion never comes into it. It's just nationalist Turks fighting against nationalist Armenians, when in reality it's Muslims killing Christians once again. Once you, you know, pry into it and dig into it, it's just another aspect of what we're talking about. And it's happening again right now, and it's still, just like then, it's not being recognized, it's not being called for what it is.
Yeah, this is amazing, yeah. And another thing about the 100th, and I hate saying anniversary, but it's remembrance
yeah.
of the Christian genocide by Obama blatantly broke a campaign promise to recognize the atrocities as that of the Ottoman Empire, that it was a Christian genocide. Why do you believe he refused to recognize this as a Christian genocide?
Well, I mean, to recognize it as Christian genocide, that's not even on the table for Obama. It's a little worse than that. He won't even call it Armenian genocide, you know, keeping it in the whole hygienic national terms. And like you said, in 08, he made the campaign promise. I mean, he just flat out said it, as president, I intend on recognizing the Armenian genocide. And in the same speech, he says, in the context of recognizing Armenian genocide, America deserves a president who speaks truthfully against things like genocides and so forth. And, you know, here's the seventh year, including on the anniversary, and Armenian groups, human rights groups were begging him, finally, please, you know, stand by your word, and he still wouldn't. The official reason, of course, is it's politics, because he can't estrange Turkey, and, you know, because, of course, when anyone mentions real history around Turkey, they go in a rage, such as Pope Francis. He actually acknowledged it as a genocide. And Turkey flew off the handle and called him as a part of a kind of a new axis of evil against Turkey and so forth. So that's his official reasoning. He didn't want to estrange Turkey, but, you know, even if it wasn't that, I don't think he would ever,
he'd,
you know,
come
really
up with another excuse.
Exactly. Yeah.
He refused. Well, he won't recognize it happening now, of course, as a serious.
And that's the point. Yeah. If he won't even recognize it's happening now under his leadership, and often caused because of his policies, I don't think he's really going to be talking about what happened 100 years ago either.
Yeah. Oh, except he, you know, effectlessly mentions the Crusades, so he'll go back and mention that, but he won't mention. Yeah. I tell you, it's a cherry picking. Yeah. It's selective amnesia.
Right. The only he invokes history if it's to make Christians look bad. That's
the
easy, you know. Yeah, he'll reach back thousands of years if he has to.
Especially if he happens to be speaking at a Christian breakfast.
Yep,
he makes sure
exactly.
that he, you know, sticks it to Christians. As a Christian, I'm doing air quotes, you can't see that himself. So,
well, see, I think Obama, the way he uses Christianity is very cynical. You know, he uses Christianity to silence Christians, I think. He kind of takes the whole turn the other cheek and be forgiving and this to the extreme, not because he really believes in that, but this is his way of getting Christians to just shut up. Okay, so people are being killed. Well, look at your own evil history, and remember, you're supposed to be more loving and tolerant and forgiving and turn the other cheek and be a doormat and never say anything against anything. And that's the kind of Christianity that I think he tries to promote, only because it serves his purposes by making Christians just shut up and never say anything.
Well, that's it, and that's a great analogy there, because it's similar to what groups like CARE do, by, you know, lawfare, against taking our laws that protect freedom and turn it against us to shut us up. So, I wonder where he got his from. Anyway, his idea. And, you know, in a Los Angeles Examiner article way back in August 1st, 1926, the man responsible for secularizing Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, affirmed those slaughters that we were just talking about. He said, and I quote, "Those left over from the former Young Turkish Party should have been made to account for the lives of millions of our Christian subjects who were ruthlessly driven en masse from their homes and massacred." End of quote. So today, Turkey continues to refuse to recognize its past. And Raymond, why won't Turkey, I know the answer, this is almost rhetorical, come clean? Is it because since the time of Atatürk, they have now moved closer to becoming an Islamic State once again?
Well, that's absolutely true. They are. They're moving back. I mean, you have to remember, Atatürk now went from being from a historical point of view, one of the greatest men in the Middle East and reformers, to now he's so hated by the Islamist types and anyone
really?
Who wants any part of Islam, of course, because he did so much that he totally sidelined Islam. He even changed the Turkish script, which back then was based on Arabic. It was the Turkish language, but it was transliterated with the Arabic script because that's the holy language of Islam. He actually removed it and adopted a Roman alphabet in an effort to become more Europeanized. And that even angered a lot of people. And he also, Hagia Sophia, which was the greatest church back then in Constantinople, which was, of course, conquered in 1453 with the Ottoman Turks and the jihad and so forth, he turned that into a museum. And, of course, now, Erdogan and the Islamist parties and people in Turkey are threatening to return that wonderful museum back into a mosque, and they probably will. And in fact, they did that after the Pope, just because the Pope acknowledged history. It's so typical. You know, you'll remember the previous Pope, Pope Benedict. He made a historical comment about Islam. In fact, he was quoting a historical text, and because it was unflattering about Islam, I think the text was a Byzantine emperor saying something like, "Show me what Islam brought other than the sword, death, and destruction." It was some rhetorical question that emperor had with a Muslim colleague. And just because he read that, what did Muslims to protest against the idea that Islam is violent, Muslims around the world acted violently and killed people, including a nun, I recall, and burned churches. And so it's funny because Turkey's acting like the Muslim mob now that this new Pope, Francis, is just basically acknowledging a historical fact that is so well documented. I mean, remember, in the United States, 44 states acknowledge the genocide. I mean, it's not really that open to debate. It's only deniers, hardcore deniers that, you know, take umbrage with it. So just because he stated a fact, Pope Francis, now Turkey and Erdogan, all these people are threatening to return what was stolen from Christendom through violence and jihad in 1453 back into a mosque. So it's just amazing, you know, how dare you call us intolerant and violent? We're going to act intolerant and violent to show you that you're wrong. And that's a constant with Turkey and elsewhere in the Islamic world.
I understand that when, of course, they were turning it into a mosque the first time, the Hagia Sophia, they were plastering over images of Jesus, and it ended up protecting them.
Yeah, well, that's the irony, because they wanted to cover it all up. You know, it ended up still remained there. So when the time, it was preserved. So at the time to return it into a museum, you know, some of it was still there to actually be used, and it's kind of ironic. But, you know, it's funny to me because Turkey is like a microcosm of the Islamic world in general, because it was the last caliphate. It was the last hardcore Islamic jihadi organization for hundreds of years. I mean, from 1415, 1600, 1700s especially, it was on the offensive. It conquered, remember, much of Eastern Europe was conquered under the sword of Islam, under the banner of Islam, you know, only a few hundred years ago. And, you know, all that, of course, and it was doing it just the same reason that the Arab caliphates before it did it, and the Mongol caliphates or the Tatars in Russia did it for the same reason, which is jihad, conquest, plunder, subjugation. So it's just one long constant, you know, for 1,400 years, and yet here we are trying to understand, well, why do they hate us? And all these little questions that we keep hearing about, and we try to project sort of socio-political, economic ideas onto them. That's why they're angry, because of this grievance or that grievance. No, it's just part of the history. And if you were acquainted with the history, the way Muslims are, and the doctrines, all this makes sense. But you know, alas, not in our world.
Right. No, forget that. In the Ottoman Empire being the last, I guess the most recent caliphate, was that recognized throughout the Muslim world as a caliphate?
Sure. Basically, in the Islamic world, historically, whoever gets the upper hand, you know, it's a survival of the fittest type thing, and whoever wins, he just becomes a leader by default. And it's not because the subjects necessarily want or like it. It's just that's who's in charge, because the caliphate will kill fellow Muslims too if they don't step in line and behave like Muslims, and they do. And in fact, it's an Islamic teaching that whoever is the leader in Islam, the caliphate or the sultan or whatever, as long as he's allowing Islam to be free and practiced, and even if he is the most corrupt human being, you have to listen to him and you have to follow and obey him. And this is, and you see this all the time, this is why a lot of these leaders in Islamic countries, you know, they themselves may be atheists, but they'll allow the Islamic thing to take its course and never interfere, because that's how they legitimize themselves amongst the populace. And so the Ottomans definitely did that. And they of all the caliphate people, Muslim peoples, really perfected the art of jihad. To give you one idea, the Janissaries, the Ottomans, one of their practices when they were at their peak would be to invade small neighboring Christian territories, and then as tribute, take the youngest, healthiest, strongest men, boys really, teenagers or under, usually even under 10 years old, take them from their parents and indoctrinate them back home in Islam and basically turn them into what we would call today a jihadi. And then these children would grow up totally indoctrinated, forgetting their Christian heritage and family, and they would be complete Islamic radical jihadis, and then they would unleash them back on their Christian villages to kill more and to take in even more children. And
wow.
To tell you the disconnect, you know, of how horrible that sounds, and it's still happening, by the way, in some parts of the Islamic world, but just to give you an idea, in the academic community, which I was part of, I recall, this practice was portrayed as such a great thing, because what the Ottomans were really doing were taking poor, impoverished Christian boys and giving them a great career in the Ottoman Empire, and actually the parents
jobs
sometimes liked it.
Is that it?
Yes. This, if you go to an elite Ivy League college, this is what they're going to teach, that this was a wonderful practice, and the parents, the Christians themselves, were eager for their boys to be taken, and because that ensured they had a great future. Okay, and so this is how you begin to understand why we here in the West are completely oblivious to Islam and its history and practices.
And the mindset, which is, completely awry from ours. Wow. That's incredible. Just lastly, Raymond, when Christians in the West see what is happening to their brethren in the Middle East and Africa, should they take heed?
Well, according to the Islamic State, you have to remember, when the Islamic State, as it did recently, decapitated, or that is to say, carved off the heads of Christians, Ethiopians, and before them Coptics from Egypt and so forth, they, in the speeches that their spokesman said in the same videos, he always addresses all Christians. He doesn't say, it's the Christians in Egypt or the Christians in Libya or whatever. He says, all you Christians around the world, take heed, because the sword of Islam is coming for you, and you're going to get the three choices that our prophet gave to your ancestors, which is convert, or pay extortion money and live a miserable existence, or die. And in fact, they keep constantly saying things like, we're coming to Rome. Because, of course, in the Islamic mindset, which is much more historically attuned than the Western one, they recall that Rome, of course, is the home of where the Crusades originates and the home of the church and so forth. And that is the original prophecy, of course, was to get these big capitals. So they got Constantinople, which was like Rome back then. And now all that's left as a symbol, really, of Christianity is the current Rome. And they're constantly talking about going into Rome and doing jihad. And eventually the Christians in Rome are going to, pay jizya or die and so forth. So, people here should take heed, because it's being addressed to them. And it may seem so distant, but, time has a way of going by fast, especially if you don't do anything.
Yeah, exactly, and because we also are aware that there are cells here, and our border is extremely porous, and so they're here. So if we think that we're safe and it couldn't possibly touch us, I think that we're being feckless. Don't you
agree? Look at some of these countries that, Syria seemed pretty stable a little while ago. Now look at it. Half of it is part of a caliphate, and these people are being butchered. I'm not saying the United States is as vulnerable as Syria, but, it happens with the passage of time. All kinds of unexpected things can happen, especially when you don't put the proper precautions to prevent them in the now. And we're not far from putting precautions. We're enabling all this stuff. And, sooner or later, it's going to bite us on the you-know-what.
Yeah, exactly. I think probably the first place that we're failing is in our rhetoric, where we won't recognize the enemy for who they are and what their ideology is. Because of that, I think that sets everything up. Don't you agree?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is ancient advice, Sun Tzu, the art of war from millennia ago. First thing he said, most important thing, know your enemy. And we're not even allowing ourselves to know our enemy, because we can't. Factor in the most important factors, which is this body of Islamic teaching. you jettisoned it. It has nothing to do with it. Islam is peace. It doesn't mean any of this. And so as long as we go down that route, then it's anything we do, it's kind of like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. It's just not going to work because we're not addressing the real issue.
Exactly. And as Sun Tzu said, if we don't know ourselves, which we're losing, and we don't know our enemy, we're gonna continue to lose. So we're not in the greatest position. Raymond, where can the listeners follow and support your brilliant work and purchase your books?
Sure. Thanks, Andre. Well, the best one place stop is just my website. I mean, it should be easy to remember. It's just my first and last name.com, Raymond, R-A-Y-M-O-N-D, I-B-R-A-H-I-M.com. And all my articles appear there, and also links to Amazon for my books, including Crucified Again, The Last Warning, which deals with many of these themes we're discussing.
Great. And I know you often, you know, I mean, you often speak, and I was just wondering, you have anything coming up in the future that is open to the public where the listeners in the area could come and support you?
Yeah. Well, one of the bigger ones coming up in June, it's in, I don't know the exact date, it can be found on the website. It's by an organization called Coptic Solidarity. And they often organize a couple of two-day events in Washington Hill, in Capitol Hill, I'm sorry, and senators and congressional people come in and listen, some speak, and it's really a lot of people. I'll be speaking there as well. I think I have a panel that I'm sharing about these topics. So if the listeners go to just Google Coptic Solidarity, they'll go to their website, and it should have all the details, the dates and locations and all that there.
Excellent. And I will, as always, in my after show, post links and any information that I will grab myself for Raymond, for all of you, in my after show again. Thanks so much, Raymond, for sharing with us. Till your next visit, may God bless you and your work. Bye for now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Audrey. Take care.